If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello, 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 and welcome once more. I'm here with the rather attractive looking Peter Hart.
I am lovely.
And I'm Gary Bain. And what are we doing today, Pete?
We're doing a night attack on the Somme, 14th of July, 1916.
Why?
Well, because it's part of a series on the Somme. We did our episodes on the planning, the preparation on the 1st of July. But do you know what? For all that pain and suffering, all the dreadful nature of the attack on the 1st of July, they were never going to stop the offensive then. People will say, why did they carry on? Well, they don't really have any choice. Why don't they have a choice, Gary?
Well, it's the Battle of the Somme's the major Allied offensive of 1916, and it's too important to set aside or be evaded because of the, let's face it, dreadful casualties.
They were dreadful, yeah.
And the French were still suffering at Verdun.
And to be honest, the armies of France and Russia, they've been slaughtered time and time again for 2 years by this time. And just because Britain's new armies get a very, let's be clear, a very bloody nose on the 1st of July, they're not going to be that sympathetic if Britain then tries to sort of duck out and say, oh, it's too painful. Well, let's do something else. And as you said, Verdun's not gone away.
Germany's still strong.
Yeah, the Somme offensive is only just beginning on the 1st of July.
Now, what happened at the end of the first day, Pete? What's the situation?
Well, they've gained ground in the south. The
French. Tell me the history, Pete.
No. they gained some ground in the south, and the French had done well on the 1st of July, often forgotten. And we will later on have a podcast on the French on the Somme. But a lot of the tactically significant features are still a considerable distance ahead of them. They haven't taken the German second line system. They've taken the German first line. This is where they're successful. They've taken the German first line system, but they haven't taken the German second line system. And in the north, they haven't even taken the first line system. They haven't taken anything. And this means that the attack on Thiepval Ridge, on the Pozières Ridge, it's utterly failed. Now, what would the Germans say this was?
Let's face it, had they been successful there, it would have provided vital observation over large sections of the German defensive system and thus destabilised the whole German line in the Somme.
So what would they call it?
That, succinctly put, they'd call it a failure, because where it mattered and succeeded was where it was tactically irrelevant.
They'd call it the Schwerpunkt.
Oh, sorry, you're asking, the Schwerpunkt.
And that is Jack Sheldon's thinking on this, that to them, they'd identify this as a crucial point. And we had got nowhere facing that. And this leads a really terrible problem. The losses that they'd suffered in the attack on Thiepval Ridge, should they bash their heads against a brick wall and try again? Or should they attack where they'd succeeded? And Rawlinson, What's Rawlins?
Well, he's inclined to grasp the ball by the metaphorical horns and to batter down the continued resistance to the north before turning to exploit the success gained in the south. Now, you're going to be General Sir Henry Rawlinson of Headquarters 4th Army.
Right. A large part of the German reserve are now being drawn in, and it's essential to keep up the pressure and wear out the defence. It's also necessary to secure as early as possible all important tactical points still in the possession of the Germans in their frontline system and intermediate line, with a view to an ultimate attack on the German second line.
Oh, that sounds remarkably easy.
Yeah. Now, what's that? Haig has a different perception. And this is quite interesting because I think this is one of Haig's greatest mistakes, what happens next. But Haig is often complimented by historians who often don't like him. For he wants to push on the south. He wants to build on the successes already achieved. Now, this is interesting because this infuriates the French. And in particular, Joffre, the French commander-in-chief. Now, you're going to be General Sir Douglas Haig, and you're going to put Haig's perception of what Joffre says. And it's quite interesting, because I think Haig, if you listen to it, I think Haig's away with the fairies here is wrong.
Joffre began by pointing out the importance of our getting to Thiepval Hill. To this, I said that in view of the progress made on my right near Montauban, and the demoralised nature of the enemy's troops in that area, I was considering the desirability of pressing my attack on Longueval. I was therefore anxious to know whether in that event the French would attack Guillemont. At this, General Joffre exploded in a fit of rage. He could not approve of it. He ordered me to attack Thiepval and Pozières. If I attacked Longueval, I would be beaten, etc., etc. I waited calmly till he had finished. His breast heaved and his face flushed. The truth is, the poor man cannot argue, nor can he easily read a map. When Joffre got out of breath, I quietly explained what my position is as regards him as the Generalissimo. I am solely responsible to the British government for the action of the British army, and I had approved the plan and must modify it to suit the changing situation as the fight progresses. I was most polite.
Now, this is interesting because I think the person who can't read the map in this occasion is Haig. Haig is not an experienced commander. He'd only been promoted in December. This is his first real battle at this level. Joffre, I think, can read a map. And Joffre is in alignment with the Germans, isn't he? Schierpunkt.
Yeah. Now, in the end, Haig overrules Rawlinson, and he's going to brave Joffre's wrath. They would attack in the south with the intention of securing a position from which the next main thrust would crash through the German second line, which stretched along the Longueval to Bazentin-Le Petit Ridge.
So that's a German second line system, yes.
We
have to keep saying
system.
Let's be clear. Because there's two or three lines in each system. Now, there's also going to be a diversionary attack at Thiepval on the 3rd of July. And they were going to maintain a sort of an overall aggressive posture north of the Albert-Bapaume Road. And this was they were hoping this would deflect the German attention to the north, which, of course, they were watching most closely of all, away from the real targets in the south, which would be assaulted when Rawlinson was ready. What state do you think the German second line system was in?
In essence, the German second line system remained intact. The British field artillery would have to be moved well forward if they were to be able to have the range to deluge these new targets. And we talked about this. They're a couple of thousand yards behind our line, so they'd have to be moved very far forward to reach the German second line. Now, this was a time-consuming and difficult process, as all the guns would have to be re-registered on their likely targets from the new observation posts.
Now, so what's happening is there's a series of piecemeal attacks launched from 7th of July on Villers, Contalmaison and Mametz Wood. What are these attacks designed for? What is the idea, Gary?
Well, the idea is that you maintain the pressure on the Germans and also to get better jumping off positions and secure the flanks before the next concerted big effort to break
Well, to break through the German
second line. Now, this is in the sector between Bazentin-le-Petit and Longueval.
Now, are they carefully coordinated, planned
in isolation, and they prove to be a disaster.
Why?
Well, as each attack fails, so another one is ordered, then another, another, and another. Now, the commanders seem to have become totally fixated with the objective, a sort of tunnel vision that fails to look around them, and they don't pause, not even for a moment's reflection as to what they're doing or indeed how.
And this is basically unfocused attacks launched by small groups of troops, often against powerful trench works. They've got varying start times. They're not coordinated. And what's the end result? You get an individual British battalion left in no man's land, being battered to buggery by German firepower, the machine guns, the artillery batteries. And they're being fired at, not only from the front, but because it's an isolated attack. We've talked about this before. They're getting fired at from the German guns on the flanks. It's not good. What's the end result?
Well, of course, it's mounting losses that are not
higher
this time.
And higher.
It's not the stunning single blow as was suffered on the 1st of July, but it's incremental. It's a drain that over days adds up to serious losses that approach some 25,000 casualties in just under, listen to this, 50 separate attacks.
Now, this is not good. Rawlinson lacks grip at this stage. He doesn't grip things. He doesn't get things organised. Luckily, he is doing something that's good. What is that?
Well, at the same time, he's making plans for the new attack on the 14th of July. That's as well conceived as the so-called preparatory attacks that led up to it were monstrously foolish.
They were foolish. Now, what's his first emphasis Rawlinson's got is an adequate artillery bombardment. And they amass some 1,000 guns, of which 311, Gary, 311 are the all-important heavy, medium and heavy artillery. This is important because they've got the range, isn't
it? Now, that's less than they had, didn't they, on the bombardment prior to the 1st of July?
Oh, yeah, but it's instead of attacking on a front of 22,000 yards and trying to deal with multiple defence lines, they're now attacking a front of just 6,000 yards, so one quarter or one third, depending on your maths. And the Germans haven't got quite as many lines behind it, because, of course, this is their second line system. There's only one system behind it. So it's not as complicated, is it? The trench lines aren't quite as strong. What are the overall calculations? I'll leave the calculations to you, because maths isn't my strong point.
It's been calculated that 66% of the original guns available would be firing on just below 5% of the original total of targets. So you've got some 500,000 shells that are going to be fired over the three-day preliminary bombardment.
Wow. Now that is a different scale, and we're starting to get the big bombardments coming, aren't we? Now, there's another problem that Rawlinson boldly addresses. This is really bold. What's that?
Well, both Rawlinson and his planning staff realise that it's clear that the attacking troops are going to be facing a no-man's land that stretch uphill over 1,500 yards in front of them. That's huge.
So what's he do? How can you overcome that problem? Sap forward or...?
Well, this is quite clever, really, for the time. He proposes that a night attack would allow the attacking battalions to edge forward under the cover of darkness to take up a position on carefully laid white marker tapes so that they're ready to launch an attack at dawn from right under the Germans' noses. Now, it's an audacious plan, but it requires careful planning and exact...
Well, they've got to know the ground, haven't they?
Yeah, no, they've got to have exact reconnaissance of the ground and a skillful execution by the attacking
troops. They're trusting the infantry now, something they hadn't really done on the 1st of July, but they're trusting the new armies.
Yeah, and there's clearly very little room for error, and disaster would be likely if the alarm's raised amongst the Germans.
Now, this is... I can imagine that... I know someone who's going to be worried by this. I mean, he's already worried by what's going on, Rawlinson's army are doing. So Haig is worried, and on the 11th of July, he intervenes, and basically he says, you can naff off. You're not, I'm sure Haig used those very words, but this is what he said.
General Sir Douglas Haig. Our troops are not highly trained and disciplined, nor are many of the staff experienced in such work, and to move two divisions in the dark, over a distance, form them up, and deliver an attack in good order and in the right direction at dawn, as proposed, would hardly be considered possible, even in a peacetime manoeuvre.
Now, this is an interesting exchange because remember that ever since Neuve Chapelle, Rawlinson, who'd behaved badly, you have to listen to our podcast to hear what, he'd not behaved well afterwards, and he was sort of, he could have been sacked for trying to trash a subordinate when it was his fault, something that went wrong. And he normally kowtows to Haig, but he doesn't this time, does he? What does he do?
Well, he engages, he protests most vigorously, and he engages in a direct dispute with Haig to retain his original concept of a night attack.
Now, I think this is interesting because Haig, it's to his credit, isn't it? I mean, we've looked at in view of, I think his tactics are probably wrong in this battle, but about the direction. But he does think about what's going on. He reconsiders the idea of a night attack, and he sends things which, to me, show what a clear thinker Haig was. What does Haig say?
I put four questions to the general staff. Can we take the position in the manner proposed? Can we hold it after capture? What will be the result in case of a failure? What are the advantages, or otherwise, of proceeding methodically, viz. Extending our front and sapping forward to take the position by assault? They all agreed that Rawlinson's new plan materially altered the chances of success, and there seemed a fair chance now of succeeding. The disadvantage of the deliberate method at once is that we must hold the German troops in our front. If the attack was allowed to die down, they might continue the attacks at Verdun or elsewhere. The news this morning shows the Germans again attacking at Verdun. Also, to encourage the French, we must keep on being active.
They wanted the French. That's interesting, isn't it? You pointed this out before. They want the French to, they want to encourage them, not only about Verdun, but also they want them to renew the attacks vigorously to the south of the Somme. The French Somme offensives, of course. Now, so Haig is fundamentally given permission.
He's persuaded, isn't he?
He is. So and that's good.
No, it is good. It shows
flexibility.
It shows flexibility, and it shows understanding of what the commander is actually responsible for. So it was agreed that there would be a combined attack by the 15th, that's the 21st and 7th Division, and the 13th Corps, which is the 3rd, 9th and 18th Divisions.
Any cavalry?
Yeah, the 2nd Indian Cavalry Division was earmarked to exploit any breakthrough by swooping forward
is the Indian for it.
On High Wood and then onto the village of Fleurs. Now, that's quite sensible, really. We've discussed it before. What other option has he got for exploiting any successes quickly?
And it's all based as usual on the artillery, and we mentioned the 3-day bombardment. Now, so the field batteries, what are they tasked
They're
with?
They're tasked to cut the German barbed wire well before the attack, and to that end sent observers into no man's land, where they sort of edged as close as they were physically able to ensure that there's no mistake.
So they could see whether the wire was cut or not. And this is because in places on the first day, the wire wasn't properly cut. And they want to make sure. That's learning from...
Now, at the same time, the heavier guns and howitzers, they're pounding all the identified German strong points.
Now, as we said, they want the maximum possible surprise, so they're going to form up in no man's land, the infantry, and then only unleash a hurricane bombardment in the brief 5 minutes, Gary, 5 minutes, that's all, before the moment of the assault. So the infantry, they line up on their tapes, and they're deep in no man's land. They're in no man's land. They're no cover. What's protecting them?
Well, the only protection they've got is the darkness and their own disciplined silence.
So we might not have been good at this.
We would have been terrible
Gary,
at this.
Gary, what's happening? Where am I? Shh!
Now, the men themselves crawling forward, they're totally aware of the risks they're being ordered to take.
They must have been. I mean, they must have been shitting themselves.
They knew what would happen if something went wrong.
Now, the barrage, that starts at 3:20 in the morning. It bursts out, and it's only 5 minutes, but, you know, what a 5 minutes.
That's what Janet says.
5 minutes.
All right.
1.5. But what a 1.5 minutes, Gary. It's everything the original Somme bomber was meant to be, but wasn't. It's the essence of destruction, isn't it? And I'm going to be Major Neil Fraser Tytler of D Battery, 149th Brigade Royal Field Artillery. The whole world broke into gunfire. It was a stupendous spectacle. The darkness lit by thousands of gun flashes. The flicker of countless bursting shells along the northern skyline. Followed a few minutes later by a succession of frantic SOS rockets and the glare of burning Hun ammunition dumps.
Wow.
Now, so what are the infantry doing during this last 5 minutes?
Well, under the bursting shells, they're edging still closer to the German line. They're intent on giving the survivors absolutely no chance of recovery when the barrage lifts.
Now, I'm quite interested. On the 1st of July, there were a few illustrations of the creeping barrage. How are we moving forward? Is it going to be a creeping barrage? I know they're not far away, but are they going to use a creeping barrage here?
Yeah, I mean, it's once more left to the discretion of the attacking divisions. There was overall a much greater emphasis on creating a genuine creeping barrage, moving in lethal synchronicity just in front of the attacking infantry, lifting some 50 yards in range every 1.5 minutes to try and keep pace with their advance.
And the infantry are going to keep as close to the rear of these bursting shells as possible. So what's the result? What is it? What happens? How does it go?
Well, it goes really well. I mean, you would describe it as a stunning success. At 3:25 in the morning, the assaulting infantry pressed forward on the very heels of the line of bursting shells, and they crashed into the remnants of the German front line.
And what's there? What's happening?
Well, they found little but the dead and the dying, frankly, Pete.
Not much opposition.
No, in many sectors, there was almost no serious opposition.
Why not?
Well, there was no one left to oppose them. There were no trenches left worthy of the name, and the Germans had simply been swept away in the tide of bursting shells.
Now, on the 9th Division front, we're only going to look at a couple of examples, but the 9th Division, it's nice to... I always remember buying their divisional history. Very lovely divisional history. And the Scots burst through the front line. They vault across two... with their kilts flying. Across two more trench lines. Just behind this barrage of shells, there's still pockets of resistance. They've got to break them down. And the 9th Scottish Rifles, a fine body of men, gets into some bitter hand-to-hand fighting as they attack something called the Longueval Redoubt. Now, you're going to be Private Barney Downs. Quite an unusual name.
It's an unusual name for a Scotsman.
It is. 9th Cameronian Scottish Rifles. What's he say?
A German fired point blank at me, and I thought he'd blown part of my face off. The pain was so intense. But instinctively lowering my rifle like a pistol, I blew the top of his head off as he came up at me. My reaction to this being, gosh, just like lifting the lid off a boiling pot. We decided to winkle Jerry out from our end by lobbying bombs over the traverses and under cover of the explosion, dash round the traverse to put him to the bayonet. Rushing round into one of the bays, there was a rather undersized, black-visaged private of the Bavarian regiment crouched on the fire step, and as I lifted the stick bomb to club him, the army lifted up in defence of the blow was just a gory mess.
Now, it sounds as if there's not much resistance, but Downs is hit, isn't he? He's hit by a bullet. He gets sniped, doesn't he, I think?
Yeah, he goes on to say, "The increasing daylight showing corn growing in the fields with trees no longer defoliated with the recurrent blasts of war. While enjoying this rustic scene in the morning sunlight, I was caught off guard when a sniper who had crept back to our new position shot me point blank through the chest. The impact was frightful and the pain terrific as the thrust of the bullet leaving me pitched me forward. The bullet went right through my right lung, just missing my spine. I started losing consciousness as the severe hemorrhage drained the lifeblood from a chilled body, warming only when the flow of blood streamed down my back. As the stretcher bearer carried me away, I was told that the sniper had been winkled out and left as full of holes as a pepper pot.
Oh, that poor sod. That's the end of his war, from the sound of it. Both Barney and the poor German sniper. Now, this fighting, where it flares up in these instances, it's pretty highly pressurised. And there's some inexperienced troops out. I mean, the South African Brigade are new to it. And there's a lovely quote. They're pushing forward. They run into the resistance stiffens, and you're going to be Private Sidney Carey of the 1st South African Infantry Regiment.
No, I'm not.
Oh, no, I want to be him. Can I be him?
You can be him.
Yeah, I notice it says me right next to him. Ah, professionalism. Wherefore art thou, professionalism?
So you're going to be Private Sidney Carey.
Oh, no, that's...
1st South African Infantry Regiment.
While going up to Longaville, my friend next to me said, "Man, but there's a lot of damn bees around here." I said, "Bees be blowed! Those are bullets flying around." Unfortunately, about 4 minutes afterwards, a bullet caught him and killed him right out.
Now, the pace of the 9th Division advance slows to a crawl as they fight their way slowly through Longaville. And finally, they're washed up against the fringes of Delville Wood and the German strong point at the Waterlop Farm sugar refinery.
I hope the South Africans, who are part of 9th Division, I hope they don't have to do any fighting in Delville Wood. That would be horrible for them. We'll find out in a subsequent episode. Now, the German, as they push deeper into the second line system and through the German opposition stiffens. What happens when German opposition stiffens?
Well, casualties obviously go up, and it's inexorably mounting.
Ooh.
You just wanted me to say the word inexorably, didn't you?
And the advance...
It's finally halted.
It stops, doesn't it? Now, on their left, the 3rd Division, they've got a lot more problems with uncut wire, because despite best efforts, people say, well, why didn't they make sure it was cut? Well, you try your best to get it cut, but sometimes there's some left. But they managed to get forward towards the main Bezentin ridge.
Now, the old German second line was breached and overrun as they swarmed forwards. Now, in the excitement and traumas of mopping up the nobler virtues of war, they're sometimes not observed. And you're going to read a quote from Sapper John Cordy of the 56th Field Company Royal Engineers.
"Dead and wounded were lying all around. One of our infantrymen was kicking a wounded German, crying out, 'You may be the bastard that killed my brother.' And that seems funny, but it's also nasty in a way. On the other hand, the tensions, the stress, it's a terrible business, isn't it?
And very human. You can understand why somebody would say that. Now, the troops push forward and they begin struggling their way through the village of Bezentin-le-Grand. So that's bigger than...
Now, what do they need as they start to advance deeper and deeper?
It's crucial that they get artillery support in attacking the deeper objectives, where the preliminary bombardment, obviously, neither so heavy nor accurate.
No, because, of course, it's starting to be... The third line of the second line system is going to be not so well thing. Well... covered with a bombardment.
It's further away.
So they have to get the forward observation post forward, and they need to have a good view over the new German front line. And then they've got to communicate with the batteries, which means, I presume, they have to leave. How are they going to communicate?
Well, it's by telephone, and in many cases, the telephone wires had not yet been laid. But even where they were, they did not stay intact for long under the German barrage.
They get blown up.
So the artillery observation work's an extremely dangerous task, for if the Germans sighted them, then they're going to be a prime target.
Well, if you see an observation post, you're going to try and take it out, because you know what they're doing. Now, you're going to be signaler... Oh, well, I see you're a bit posh in this one. I couldn't find this bloke's name. Signaler FJG Gambling of B Battery, 97th Brigade Royal Field Artillery.
During the afternoon, our artillery concentrated their fire upon Bezentin-le-Petit and Shelter Wood. This wood is, or rather was, situated upon a slope, and at the top, in a small clearing, there stood a crucifix made of wood. As our position was close by, we used this place to signal from, with flags. It was also not very far from the first line trenches and could be plainly seen from the German lines. We were busy signalling from this spot when Fritz caught sight of us and of course put one of his guns on us. The first shell dropped just in the rear, and then he got the range all right, for he absolutely levelled the ground, or rather made holes in it, smashing the crucifix to smithereens and turning the trees round about into sawdust. As for ourselves, we dived at once for the nearest shelter we could find. Some of us were lucky enough to get there, but two of the chaps were not. One of them was blown to smithereens, and the other's head was completely cut off. That finished our signalling there for that day. The body of the one chap and the few pieces we could find of the other were buried where they fell.
Very matter of fact, but that's horrible. Now, in one sense, they've been a bit unlucky, the British, because they've made this brilliant attack and they seem to have timed it well, but for one tiny thing. They'd expected local counterattacks, but the attack coincided with the arrival in the battle area of the relief division. So there's sort of two, they're in the middle of a relief of the German divisions. So they end up having the best part of two of them there, which is a bit unfortunate. And so these troops, they haven't been in the bombardments, so that they launch quite vigorous counterattacks, don't they? Hammering where?
Well, they hammer time and time again against the villages Bazentin-le-Petit and Bazentin-le-Grand.
And that pretty well stops any further forward movement. Because the troops on Bazentin Ridge are just trying to hold what they've got.
It's always
the same with the Germans, a counterattack.
They counterattack. And as the infantry begin to run out of steam, this, if any, was the moment at which the mobile power of the cavalry should have been swiftly deployed to push through the infantry to exploit the German confusion.
If there was German confusion as well. Yes, I see what you mean. Now, so once Delville Wood and Bazentin-le-Petit were captured, they were to deploy forward to take the high wood before advance to capture Flers and Eaucourt-l'Abbaye. Now, that's a theory, but that's not going to happen. Because what happens to the cavalry?
Well,
they've got to get forward. How do they get forward across that battlefield?
Well, they find it almost impossible to get across the broken ground, and most were stymied well before the new front line. Indeed, by the early evening of only the 7th Dragoon Guards and 20th Deccan Horse managed to make their way forwards onto the high ground that stretched between Delville Wood and Highwood.
Now, I'm going to be signaller Leonard Ownsworth of the 124th Heavy Battery Royal Garrison Artillery. Big bangy things, Gary. Big bangy things. And he says this: a Marine Saulnier kept diving down onto the corner of the field on our left front. I saw the Deccan Horse, and this plane was diving down and up again. Suddenly the officer of the cavalry cottoned on. He stood up in his stirrups, waved his sword above his head, and just charged across that field like a bat out of hell. They made a pincer movement and encircled them. It was all over in a matter of seconds. The next thing we saw was 34 Jerry prisoners, some with heavy machine guns. They were waiting while the cavalry got a bit nearer. My God, they'd have slaughtered them. The plane was trying to draw their attention, just diving down on top. I suppose it distracted these machine gunners as well.
Now, as they moved forward, other German machine gunners forced them to the ground.
The cavalry, yeah.
And they took up a dismounted line stretching from Longueval to the southern corner of High Wood. By the early evening, sufficient infantry reserves had arrived to allow a partial resumption of their advance, and elements of the 7th and 33rd Divisions managed to gain a fairly solid foothold on High Wood.
But a foothold. They don't capture it, they get a foothold in it. Now, people sometimes suggest that Rawlinson was a bit slow, that he shouldn't have waited for the cavalry because they don't do anything, that the infantry should have got the finger out and gone earlier. Taken High Wood, they imply it was almost empty, but the Royal Flying Corps, after all, they'd said that the wood was completely free of Germans in the afternoon. Well, what would you say to my suppositions here?
Well, for one, it ignores the difficulty experienced along most of the new line as it was holding back the German counterattacks.
In other words, they were in F trouble.
Yeah, and the second thing I'd say is whatever the RFC observers might have thought they'd seen, they couldn't penetrate the inner fastness of that wood. They couldn't see whether there were Germans there or not. And in fact, the Germans were there and in some strength.
So, because you can't see tree things.
They're in the way.
Yeah. We've got to switch attention now to something that's actually going on at the same time. But it is easier dealt with separately. It's a separate tussle, isn't it? Now, they decided that they had to take Trones Wood, and they'd been trying to take Trones Wood as in these preliminary attacks, you know, before the main attack. It stuck right into the side of the intended attack on Byzantine Ridge, and it looked like it would offer, well, flanking fire. That's
from the right, isn't it? Yeah. So that's on the right.
That might cost thousands of lives if it was still occupied by the Germans with machine guns in there. So, however, night falls on 13th of July, the day before, and it's still most of it's still held by the Germans. And time's all but run out. So Rawlinson orders a last desperate effort, and he chooses 54th Brigade of 18th Division to make that attack on that night before the dawn attack. They were to advance in the dark and then seize and consolidate the whole wood and form a defensive flank along the eastern face, thus covering the advance of the 9th Division, the lads we were just been talking about. Now, who's placed in charge of this? Well, Colonel Frank Maxwell. We're going to hear lots of this over the next few podcasts. He's a bit of a character. He's immune to fear, as far as we can see. There's this a lovely quote, which has so many different meanings that I'm not even going to allow any. I don't want any of you to think what else it might mean.
This is Lieutenant Colonel Frank Maxwell, VC.
VC?
Of the 12th Middlesex Regiment, writing home to his wife. He says, "A man may be squandered over me without any more feeling about it than being sorry for his poor mother or wife. I mean, of course, that it does not incapacitate my system in the least."
He really is just a different type of person. He's quite a likeable character in some ways, but also you wouldn't want to get the wrong side of him, definitely not. It's not a normal reaction, is it?
No, it's not, and it's little wonder that...
He means if someone splattered all
over
him.
I know exactly what he means. But it's little wonder that many of his men had difficulty living up to his standards of conduct during battle situations, is it? I mean, Maxwell's a hero. He'd already won a Victoria Cross, and he was simply not as other men.
Was he like you? No.
Well, he was, in that he set a standard they could perhaps aspire to, but with little hope of success. You look at me in that way, don't you?
I do look at you in that way. I think, if only I could be like Gary. Anyway, now he's an experienced officer, he reviews the place. He's got to take Trones Wood, a night attack. So what does he's thinking about it that night? What happens?
From 11 p.m. onwards, get busy for an attack on the Trones Wood, which had been taken more or less, lost and retaken about 3 or 4 times. Finally, it had to be taken and kept at all costs. The North Ants and my regiment, under myself, were ordered to do it. Not a pleasant or easy job to take on and be warned off for at 2 a.m. to get across the open before daylight to the edge of the wood or be Maxim gunned out of existence.
Now, the short notes, it looks pretty hopeless, and it's terrible organisational problems getting his battalion, the North Ants, there as well. His unit wasn't expecting to be ordered for. They were scattered about. They were in the wrong place. There was various conflicting orders. This is what happens if you change plans. But people always say, why didn't you change your plans? But if you change your plans, some people get the new orders and some people have the old orders. There's all sorts going wrong. What does he end up with?
Well, he ends up with two Middlesex companies ready in the right place at the right time. And he's forced to send the 6th North Ants in first. Now, in the event they're delayed... Everybody's delayed to such an extent that they were attacking at roughly the same time as the main assault.
But still providing some cover, because people won't be shooting off to the flank if they're attacking. They're not that self-sacrificial. So what happens first? The North Ants attack first, and they disappear into this wood. And it still is a wood. What does Maxwell say?
Maxwell says, "We crossed... just as dawn was breaking, a half mile of open ground to the wood, passing through a very thick enemy barrage of shell. The edge of the wood we were aiming for was held by a battalion that had managed to stay in at the last attack. We got over wonderfully well, and only one or two parties were blown away, which was wonderful. Men were very good and steady. On arrival at wood, my orders were for the battalion to halt at the edge and reform. But the CO got muddled and didn't do this, and consequently hadn't a dog's chance of doing anything except be killed just in the same way that other regiments had been for the same fault. Fortunately, I stopped mine inside and kept them in hand. then waited for reports to come back from the North Ants. None came, nor could come, as they were soon lost and broken up into small bodies playing just the same game the Germans like, for it let them fire at them from sideways and behind.
Now, Maxwell is realising things are going wrong, and he goes forward into the wood himself to see what he can do, and he sees that this is going to be a bloody bastard of a problem. There's no two ways about it. It's going to be difficult. So what does Maxwell say?
To talk of a wood is to talk rot. It was the most dreadful tangle of dense trees and undergrowth imaginable, with deep, yawning, broken trenches crisscrossing about it. Every tree broken off at top or bottom and branches cut away, so that the floor of the wood was almost an impenetrable tangle of timber, branches, undergrowth, etc., blown to pieces by British and German heavy guns for a week. Never was anything so perfectly dreadful to look at. At least I couldn't dream of anything worse, particularly with its dreadful addiction of corpses and wounded men, many lying there for days and days. So dense is the tangle that even if one finds a man, gets someone to bandage him, and then leaves him, you've lost him probably, simply because you can't find your way back to him.
Wow, I think addiction is my mistake in the thing. I think that must be addition.
Or addiction.
Could it?
It could be addiction, I think.
I'll have to look up the original quote. I'm just worried I've misled you there. But anyway, it's a fantastic quote from him. Now, the North Ants, they've been smashed. So Maxwell thinks of his own method of dealing with the problems of fighting in that awful wood. That, well, wood, it's still a wood, but it's tangled, it's smashed, it's broken, it's almost impossible. And he comes up with an unbelievable idea, which many modern commentators might laugh at. What was his idea?
Well, it's based on the hunting, shooting and fishing mentality of the old-style regular officers that filled the old pre-war regular army. But in these circumstances, that kind of experience seems completely relevant to Maxwell. He'd form a single line and he would beat the woods from end to end as if he were flushing out pheasants for a shooting party.
Which is the background he comes from.
Exactly. Now, this is what he says about it. I formed a line with fragments of the North Ants and two companies of my own with a job lot of about five very young officers, all the rest being hors de combat. After infinite difficulty, I got it shaped in the right direction and then began the advance very, very slowly. Men nearly all very much shaken by the clamour and din of shellfire and nervy and jumpy about advancing in such a tangle of debris and branches. I'd meant only to organise and start the line and then get back to my loathsome ditch back near the edge of the wood where we had entered so as to be in communication by runners with the brigade and the world outside. It is a fundamental principle that commanders of any force should not play about but keep in touch with the higher authorities behind. But though an old enough soldier to realise this, and the wrath of my seniors for disregarding it, I immediately found that without me being there, the thing would collapse in a few minutes. Sounds vain, perhaps, but there is nothing of vanity about it, really. So off I went with the line, leading it, pulling it on, keeping its direction, keeping it from its hopeless and humanly natural desire to get into single file behind me. Instead of a long
line... That's
what
I do.
Instead of a long line either side. Soon I made them advance with fixed bayonets and ordered them to fire ahead of them into the tangle all the way. This was a good move and gave them confidence, and so we went on with constant halts to adjust the line. After slow progress in this way, my left came on a hornet's nest, and I halted the line and went for it with the left portion. A curtain may be drawn over this, and all that need be said was that many Germans ceased to live, and we took a machine gun. Then on again, and then began what I hoped for. The Germans couldn't face a long line, offering no scattered groups to be killed. They began to bolt, first back, then, as the wood became narrow, they bolted out to the sides, and with rifle and automatic guns, we slew them. Right up to the very top this went on, and I could have had a much bigger bag, except that I did not want to show my people out of the wood too much for fear of letting the German artillery know how we had progressed, and so enable them to plaster the wood pari passu with our advance. So far, they had only laid it on thick, strong and deadly, in the belt we had left behind. And finally, the job was done. And I was thankful, for I thought we should never get through it.
Now, they'd done really... I think they'd done brilliantly, hadn't they? They'd taken Trones Wood, and they had been successful in preventing the German garrison from firing into the exposed open flank of the 9th Division. Well, we dealt with the 9th Division's attack, and it was successful. So this is a good operation. They've done well, haven't they?
They have. Now, the aftermath of the fighting that day was truly ghastly to behold. And Signal Leonard Ounsworth, for one, could barely believe his eyes when a day later he was sent across into what remained of the wood. And you're going to be Signaller Leonard Ounsworth of 124th Heavy Battery, Royal Garrison Artillery.
Well, good God, there was no trees intact at all. Just stumps, treetops and barbed wire all mixed up together. Bodies all over the place. Jerry's and ours. Robbins, that's his mate, he pulled some undergrowth up and there was a dead Jerry shot away right up to his hip. All his guts were out and flies on him. He just had to step back and this leg up in the tree became dislodged and fell across him on his head. Good Lord, he vomited on the spot. Terrible. That gives you quite an idea. It's quite graphic. That was from oral history. I remember that's an interview the War Museum did in the 70s. I think, I can't remember which interviewer did it, but you can imagine sitting across from a bloke telling you that.
That's awful. It does sound terrible. Now, overall, the attack on the 14th of July, which was known subsequently as the Battle of Bazentin Ridge, it's undoubtedly been a success in its declared intention of capturing the German former second line.
All that second line system, all of it. So all they've taken it.
That's... Yeah, but for all this tactical success, it remained true that the 4th Army had emphatically not succeeded in achieving the true breakthrough that might have beckoned towards a strategic success.
Yeah, you're right, because they're just catching up. They still haven't taken the original objectives, even in the south where they were successful. They haven't taken the original objectives for the 1st of July, have they?
No, but nevertheless, some real hope exists of an accelerated British advance in the weeks that would follow, and in late July and early August. So... Well, the German defences are steadily weakening as they struggle to recreate in just a few days from scratch the ground, the fortress lines that had served them so well on the 1st
of
July.
Now, the first line, their front line system is now what was the third line, the third line system. So what's first will be last and or whatever. So now they've got to make two more systems behind that.
Yeah, and now the British, they're standing on Bazentin Ridge and the French army would at last rejoin the attack north of on the Somme River.
They've had a bit of a lie down and think about things, haven't they?
Yeah.
They did well on the 1st of July, but they've not been as active. This is filling me with optimism now. You've persuaded me, Gary. If the British keep their nerve, if the French join them in, and if they all push forward together, surely victory will be theirs.
Or would it?
Well, we'll find out, won't we? We'll find out. We'll be back to join them in something called Summer Madness. Right. Thanks for your assistance and help.
Thanks, Pete.
Cheers.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?